So let's welcome Dr. Taylor.
Very good. Excuse me. It's very good to see you all. I'm still a little jangled from the drive. Unlike last week, it was really crazy. And I can only project, because it's all projection, that the highways are filled with people desperately trying to find gifts that they aren't able to find. And desperately imagining the love they hope to give and get, which the gifts will not be adequate representations of which. Can we do that? Rhubarb. Peas and carrots. Thank you. So my shameless projection was that I was driving through this sea of relationally distressed folks. And that meant that they were all driving like lunatics. And I passed two accidents. And that's two more than I usually see. So I'm still a little jangly from that. I recognize several faces from last week. I also see several people who were not here last week. So I feel sort of obligated to do a thumbnail of what last week was all about. The primary question for me from little kid on was, is there a significant reality beyond the obvious physical reality that we all live with? Is that all just bullshit and wishful thinking, or is there really something underneath the surface of appearance? And to begin with the assumption that the answer is yes, and that whatever that is should be called God, is of dubious usefulness from my point of view. This is supposed to be personal theology. I actually have a doctorate in sacred theology. And so, unfortunately, I have more of authority to speak about that kind of stuff than people who don't. That shouldn't be true, but it is. And with the added authority of a doctor of sacred theology, let me tell you, it's all garbage. That anything worthy of the once noble name God, I'm not sure it is anymore, but there was a time when God was a noble name. Anything worthy of that noble name is way too big and deep and complex and evolutionary to be adequately contained in any world religious tradition. They all are interesting efforts to do that, but the moment they decide that they're the only ones and that everybody else is wrong, we are at best circling the drain. And at worst, we're all the way down. There is a reality beyond the reality of obvious appearance. And every single one of us has regular direct contact with it through the dreams that we remember from sleep. And if you pay conscious attention to your own and other people's dreams, that reality will slowly unfold and reveal itself. And in the process of unfolding and revealing itself, it will reveal that there are reliable patterns there that repeat beyond the time frame of any individual human life. So there are patterns in what Carl Jung calls the collective unconscious that persist, that were fully in place and active before anybody in this room was born, and show every sign of persisting in their same basic form after every single person in this room has shuffled off this mortal coil. So it has always seemed to me, once I got that figured out, that paying attention to dreams was one of the only sensible things around to do. And I still live in a world where even my colleagues, particularly my therapy colleagues who spend a lot of time listening to other people's dreams and mostly not paying any attention to their own. Because it's too hard. It's too difficult. Lord, am I tired of hearing that. And when that is done, a couple of things become clear. Can't take my word for it. Obviously, I can't ask you to take my word for it. The best I can do is try and explain as clearly as I can what experience of mine has convinced me that this is so. The first and most important and most controversial is that all dreams, emphasis on the all, come ultimately in the service of health and wholeness and speak a universal language. And one of the reasons I'm so enthusiastic about Carl Jung is that for me, an English speaker, he has more interesting and valuable things to say about that universal language than anybody else I'm aware of. And he got a bunch of stuff wrong. And probably my fiercest professional battles are with brother and sister and beyond gender colleagues who have deified Jung. And I understand the desire to believe that there is some sort of perfect external authority and that all we have to do is to learn more deeply about it and do what they tell us to do. There is an immature longing for that kind of loss of freedom. But one of the things about our Unitarian Universalist checkered, extremely badly administered tradition is that there is a clear recognition that despite the vulnerability to error that individual conscience is constantly heir to, individual conscience remains the only reliable touchstone of non-physical truth that we've got. But it is not infallible. It is just the best we've got. It reminds me of all those British media people who crowded around Winston Churchill after the war when he lost the elections. And I think it was Clement Attlee who got elected instead of him, some big Welsh mining labor union guy who Churchill hated and who hated Churchill. And he was the man, you know, he was the great lion who brought Britain through World War II, blah, blah, blah. So they all came up to him and said, "Oh, Winston, does this make you feel that democracy itself is a dangerous failure?" Question we might be asking ourselves right now, even. And Churchill said, bless his aristocratic little heart, "It's a terrible form of government. It's just awful, but it's still the best we've got." And one can say, I believe the same thing about Unitarian Universalism. It's a terrible form of organized religion, but it remains the best we've got. So given that, it becomes, I believe, a moral imperative for folks who have chosen religious freedom over handing our puppet strings off to other people to pay attention to the direct access that we all have to this source of meaning and value beyond the obvious surface of appearance, the physical life that we are aware of when we are awake. And paying attention to that for more than five decades, I just turned 75, so I can say with certainty that for at least 70 of those years, I have been primarily interested in dreams and what's going on with dreams and what is all this stuff about and why is it that everybody dreams, that there is no such thing as a person who doesn't dream. Anybody who tells you they don't dream is in fact confessing that they've gotten out of the habit of paying attention to that aspect of their experience. And that when you do pay consistent attention to that aspect of our appearance, of appearance, then what Carl Jung talks about and gives us non-theological language to use, he calls them archetypes of the collective unconscious. The more we recognize the fingerprints of the archetypes of the collective unconscious in our own lives, awake and asleep. It's easy to see it, well, not easy, but easier to see it in the dreams remembered from sleep. But once you begin to encounter those patterns, if you are awake at all when you're awake, you will be forced to realize that those same patterns express themselves with the same regularity and reliability when we are awake. Which leads me to say, in conversation with people who are not going to attack me for saying it, there is a dream that masquerades as waking life. So there are the dreams that we remember from sleep, and then there is the dream that masquerades as waking life, and it is, I shouldn't even have to point it out, gorgeous. Absolutely heart-stoppingly gorgeous. And it has this particular advantage. It allows us to interact with each other more consciously than we interact with each other in the dream state. Now, interacting with one another in the dream state is a complicated and difficult issue. It took me decades to realize, yes, we do communicate with one another in our dreams. We have these creaky 19th century terms for it, like telepathy. Terrible language because it brings with it this aura of association. And one of the things about dreams is that whatever is being experienced in the moment or remembered is being experienced and remembered because of the totality of associations that that element carries, including unconscious associations, which is one of the reasons why the dreams of small children reflect what Jung would call archetypal patterns, even in culturally deprived circumstances where those children have had no conscious exposure to any of the world's mythology and religion, which is where those waking life patterns are most easily encountered. And I know that because it became a crucial question to answer. And one of the best ways I could figure it out to answer it decades ago was to go work in the Head Start program. So I worked in Marin Head Start for several years and rose through the ranks and became the director of the program. And little preschool children regularly recount extraordinary archetypal imagery in their dreams, even when they haven't had association with television. And those patterns can be discerned by anybody who's been paying attention, who's been watching them and listening to what other people, the names other people use for them. In my experience, the archetypes of the collective unconscious are real. We are not making it up. But of course, it interfaces with the edges of our own personal unconscious. So at some level, we're always making it up. This philosophical question about human freedom also, it seems to me, becomes easily, if unsatisfactorily, answered by keeping an eye a serious, consistent eye on dreams remembered from sleep. The answer to the question, are we free, is yes, we are free. We are free to do what we consciously decide to do. What we are not free to do is to ignore the consequences of our actions. And the more we know about archetypes, the easier it is to predict the consequences of our actions, which may seem irrational, but which are as consistent as the laws of gravity. As a matter of fact, let me try and quote a poem of mine that I wrote decades ago. Newton, spinning starstruck from his encounter with Eve's apple, invested everything with the dignity of numbers. But in his rational passion, he forgot that the attraction of all things for one another and themselves is another metaphor of love. And it is as poetic to say that love attracts like a magnet as to say that a magnet attracts ferrous metal like love. They are different ways of saying the same thing. And it is, from my point of view, not only perfectly rational, but one of the only defensible rational positions left once you begin to understand this stuff beyond the surface of obvious appearance, is that gravity is another manifestation of love. That in fact, the entire expletive deleted universe is held together by love. Because you can't tell the difference between love and gravity once you're using decent, honest definitions. And coming to decent, honest definitions of the unseen elements in our own lives is one of the most morally engaging and creatively exciting things that anybody can do. And as a result of that, I have devoted my life, since I figured that out, into democratizing dreamwork. When I started out 5+ decades ago, the only people doing dreamwork outside of the analyst's office were less than adequately socially integrated occultists of various kinds. Interesting, brave folk, but more doctrinaire than the Pope. And for the same reason of telling the Pope, thank you for sharing, I have had to say to many of the occultists, thank you for sharing. Your insights are very interesting. I see them as phenomena in a collective dream, and you see them as exclusive truth that excludes everybody else except you, and that is a bad plan. The evidence that it's a bad plan is overwhelming. If you haven't noticed that it's a bad plan, you might want to look a little more carefully. So the more carefully we look at our experience, the more obvious it becomes. If we widen our view, if we begin to pay attention not only to what I will call the propaganda of waking life. I had an amusing dream the other day in which my alarm went off, and in the dream I heard the alarm, and the person I was talking to said, oh, don't pay any attention to that. That's just propaganda for waking life. And I'm inclined to think that my interlocutor was correct, but it was very insistent, and I woke up anyway. That's one of the problems with living in the clock and calendar world, is that, yes, it's illusory, but it's such a persistent and all-pervasive illusion, there is a moral obligation to take it seriously as well, even as the evidence accumulates that it's not the whole story. And I am now convinced, obviously I can't ask anybody to take my word for it, but I'm now convinced that what we think of as the dream, based on what we remember when we wake up, is a preparation for the experience of the psyche or the soul or whatever you want to call it. If contemporary science tells us anything, it tells us that energy cannot be created or destroyed, only changed from one form into another. So the question remains, what happens to the energy of waking life when somebody dies? If it is really energy, and it seems like the evidence is very clear, then that energy can't be destroyed. It becomes something else. And the something else, we have all of these clues. Every time we wake up, we have clues about what that something else looks like. And all kinds of wise folk from the entire spectrum of world religion. One of the great advantages of living in these parlous times is that if you're curious enough, let me go back to the title, curiosity is, in my experience and deep conviction, the most important and reliable religious emotion that we have. If you're curious, you can read relatively decent translations of all the world's sacred narratives. One of the advantages of the time that we live in is that there are no more traditions that are closed to us by language barriers. And if you take advantage of this extraordinary moment, you can begin to look at the sacred narratives of even the tiniest and seemingly craziest little sects. I'm thinking at this moment of the Tennessee snake handlers. Strange bunch of folks. But even their sacred texts exhibit archetypal forms and patterns. They are not different from us in that regard. And they begin to understand the symbolic quality of the snake better than most of us do. And they make this terrible blunder of mistaken literalism. They understand that their symbolic understanding of the snake is actually literal and keeps them from being injured by poisonous snake bite. And every couple of years, there's a story that sneaks its way into the media in some way or another of someone who didn't prepare properly at one of those transcendently excited snake handling meetings, who got bitten and either died or almost died from it. And the problem, like all encounter with dream material, we're now talking about the dream that masquerades as waking life, is mistaken literalism. Premature closure and mistaken literalism, which in fact amount to the same thing. Premature closure is regularly the result of literalism. And we think, well, you got to treat the clock and calendar world literally. Well, no, you don't. And the testimony of world religions about how difficult and complicated it gets when you don't do that anymore is pretty uniform. It's not like it's easy, but at some point or another, it becomes the only possible thing to do. It's like not stepping off the curb into the stream of freeway traffic. You don't have to have had an epiphany to know it's probably not a good idea. I should probably wait for a break in the traffic. That seems reasonable. And yet when we are unaware of the symbolic implications of waking life, we are likely not to see the traffic The traffic may, in fact, be quite obvious to friends of ours who do see it, and they may gently say, well, you know, stepping off into that traffic is probably not the best thing. And we go, but I must. My ethics require it. With any luck, the friends will be around to ride to the hospital in the ambulance with you after you do that. So the more information you internalize about what has usually been called the unseen world, I don't even like that terminology because, in fact, it's not unseen. If we pay attention, we get to see it at least once every sleeping cycle. The more we know about what we see, the more valuable that information becomes. And at a community organizing level, the main problem with that is that us dreamers, the ones who have the dreams to begin with, are, in my experience, please don't take my word for it, but at least maybe you can see why I've come to believe it. Us dreamers are the only ones who can say with any certainty what the deeper meanings and implications of our own dreams may be. Unitarians and Universalists got it right. That's one of the reasons why I'm a Unitarian Universalist, despite all this other foolishness. If we didn't exist, it would be our job to invent Unitarian Universalism. Fortunately, others came before us. So we don't have to do that particular job. The more we know about this material, the simpler at one level our lives become. But at the clock and calendar and general social approval level, the more complicated our lives appear to be. So it leads me directly to the conclusion that I have been grimly wishing was not the case now for about a decade, which is that it appears to be true that the more psycho-spiritually adult, mature, and involved we become, the more inevitable it is that we will have to consciously confront unresolvable paradox. That we will have to enter the clock and calendar world with what looks like cowardly suspended judgment, but which in fact is this situation that everybody else thinks is so clear is so paradoxical that whatever plans people are proposing are fairly clearly dangerous, will fairly clearly lead to more trouble than they will solve. So our question becomes, what can we do that isn't going to be like that? And my experience is that the best answer to that question is to get involved with people we care about, who care about us, who are paying attention to their dreams and are interested in mine, so that the fact that us dreamers are the only ones who can say, but who at the same time will be uniquely and selectively blind to the deepest and most important implications of our own dreams. I used to think it was some sort of error we were making and had to do with egotism or stupidity or something like that. And I'm now convinced that that's not true. It's just in the nature of consciousness itself, waking clock and calendar consciousness, that we will be uniquely and selectively blind to the deeper implications of our own dreams. And projection being what it is, the most important thing about projection being it is always unconscious, other people will see in my dreams what I am missing myself. So that getting together in small groups and sharing dreams with one another and projecting on one another's dreams honestly and saying, this is my imagined version of your dream. Can't possibly be anything more than that. And my imagined version of your dream causes me to think X, Y, and Z. Now, one of the problems with the word unconscious from my point of view is that it is cobbled together from Latin roots. And the main reason for that is the social prominence that Latin has in the world of professionally educated folks. And I believe that that is a consequence of the persistence of Roman models for ideal society. And that the Romans got a bunch of stuff wrong because it was just too difficult to deal with. The Celts, for instance, knew that winter begins on November 1st, that the winter months are November, December, and January, and that the spring months are February, March, and April, and the summer months are May, June, and July, and the autumn months are August, September, and October. We all know that in our psyches. We know that in our hearts. But the Romans came along and went, that's not measurable enough. That's uncomfortably vague. So they said, the seasons will begin on the solstices and the equinoxes, and the deeper truth of the matter is that in our psyches, we all know that the equinoxes and the solstices are mid-seasonal festivals. And we know, for instance, that Shakespeare is right, that the shortest night of the year is midsummer. It's not the beginning of summer. Summer is not a season where the days get shorter and shorter and shorter only. It's a season where they get longer and longer until midsummer, and then the balance shifts and the days get shorter and shorter until you reach midwinter, the longest night of the year here in the Northern Hemisphere. And that's halfway into winter. That's the depth of winter. That's midwinter. And to say that winter doesn't begin until we hit the longest night of the year throws us off emotionally, collectively. For literally half the year, broken up into four increments, we are out of tune with nature. So in some sense, it reflects the way that our collectivity has gotten increasingly out of touch with nature. There's just another example of how that works. And the further out of touch with nature we get, the harder it is for us to understand how nature operates in our own psyches and our own bodies. And our dreams are constantly coming to remind us of what mistakes we have made in that regard. All dreams, in my experience, come in the service of health and wholeness and speak a universal language. And that language is learnable. It is possible to understand that language consciously better. And it's, in my experience, it's not possible to learn that language well enough for those previously unconscious processes like projection to become conscious. My sense is that that's not possible, but what I know is possible is that we can begin to recognize the consequences of our unconscious processes much more quickly. We can sense an emotional shift in the dream that masquerades as waking life and go, ooh, I recognize what that's like. That means I just projected a moment ago. This is what happens when I project my stuff, when I give away parts of my own being and pretend that they belong to other people. And right there, you have the deep unconscious mechanism. I hate to use a term like that. The deep unconscious biological process would be a better way of saying it, by which all the institutional oppressions that ruin our lives arrive out in the world. Racism and classism and sexism and my religion is better than yours-ism and temporarily ableism and the whole raft, they are all the result of unconsciously feeling things inside us which we don't like, and we don't like them to the extent of not even wanting to admit that they're in there. And the moment we do that, boom, we encounter them in what appears to be external reality. That's what projection does. It pushes out into what appears to be the external world, the very things in ourselves which we are unwilling to acknowledge and admit, which means that this dream work business constantly requires courage and curiosity. And without curiosity, it doesn't work. And without courage, it doesn't work. And my experience, for what it's worth, is it's easier to generate courage out of curiosity than it is to create curiosity out of courage. No matter how courageous we are, it's hard to know where to put it. One of the archetypes of professional militarism is that when things have really gone against you, when you've lost, the thing to do is kill yourself, to fall on your sword. And that essentially anti-life, anti-truth strategy becomes the highest noble calling. Unless people we don't like are doing it, in which case we call them terrorists. But anything that you would be willing to die for is paradoxically a doorway into what could turn you into a terrorist. And once those ambiguities become sufficiently clear, developing conscious strategies to deal creatively with them flows naturally. And it doesn't mean that carrying them out is easy, but it does mean that it's worth trying to figure out how to carry them out. I mentioned it last week, but let me say it again. All kinds of people dream about cancer by name. Statistics say more than half of the people in this room have had dreams where cancer was named in the dream. My experience as a dream worker is that if you dreamed about cancer by name, the likelihood that you are actually subject to the disease itself is very small. Because in the dream world, cancer by name is the revenge of unlived life. Life exploding on its own without proper integration with the life of the whole being. And statistically, in my experience, the unlived life which is more likely to manifest in the dream world as cancer is creative life. So to dream about cancer is to get a nudgy early warning that your creative life is asking for conscious attention, is asking for energy to be directed toward it, even if I'm not even clear what it is that I am called to do. Which doesn't mean that people don't dream about cancer, the disease. When they dream about cancer, the disease, it regularly takes the symbolic form of how the disease operates in the body. Some of you know one of my most moving and influential dreams came from a dream group that met at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation up in Moran. And there was a woman in there who dreamed in a long, complicated dream that she had a purse over her arm and that there was rotting meat in the purse. And she was therefore afraid to open it because she thought the smell would offend people. And it turned out that that was a dream about uterine cancer. And one of the important things about her dream group pointing that out to her was that she, even though she dismissed the suggestion at the time, it clung to her. It irritated her. And she couldn't get away from remembering the dream and remembering what people had said about it. And she was a Kaiser member. So she went off to Kaiser assuming that if she had a pap test, it would come back negative and that would relieve her anxiety. So she went off and had a pap test and it came back negative. And to her amazement, it caused her panic. Because somewhere unconsciously she knew that the suggestion that the rotting meat in her purse was in fact related to a very aggressive and quick-growing cancer in her uterine package, and that surprising insight caused her to go to the next level of analysis, which Kaiser was institutionally opposed to. Kaiser operates by medicine by memo. And the memo said, if you have a negative result, that's it. Don't waste the resources of the organization on further testing. And she was intelligent and middle class and strong enough to bring her full communicative powers to bear and to say, listen, I've been a Kaiser member for decades. I'm not a hypochondriac. I have not overused this system. You can look at my record and see that that's true. And I want the next level of testing. And if you don't give it to me, I'm going to complain to your superiors. And they all went, okay. And they gave her the next level, which happened to be a sonogram. And that sonogram revealed an unusual thickening of the wall of her uterus, which led them to do a needle biopsy. And as a result of the needle biopsy, they told her within 24 hours to cancel all her appointments and get into the hospital because it was one of the most aggressive cancers they had ever seen. But it was at an earlier stage than they had ever encountered. And they were very interested in what tipped her off, because it was the earliest. She showed it earlier than anybody else did, and she had the good sense not to tell her that it was a result of a dream. But eventually, when it was all done, she did tell them that, and she asked them, you know, if I had told you that earlier, would you have moved ahead in this way? And they said, well, no, we wouldn't. So it becomes even clearer that once you enter this realm, all kinds of conventional knowledge has to be looked at afresh. You have to be willing to behave metaphorically like a criminal. That people who dream they are criminals very often are dreaming about having reached a place in their lives where some deep understanding is that the conventional wisdom that they are operating on is inadequate, and they must reject the metaphoric law of convention. I love it when just theory does that. So, anyway, I think you can see how it all works. I would not call it theology unless I was talking to a room full of theological students, in which case I would say, this is the theology you're not being taught. This is the real thing. This is where the rubber meets the road, where psyche meets the divine in a direct experiential way. And, of course, people don't teach it because they don't know how. They don't even recognize that that's what's going on. But that is what's going on, and this access to the deep inner truth has been available to us probably since before we evolved the form of Homo sapiens. And I'm very grateful to Lonnie for giving you specific examples of how her encounter with her own dreams is leading her to deeper and more reliable decisions about her own life. And I can say with confidence that, statistically speaking, that is what always happens. And again, it brings me back to Carl Jung. I'm very fond of him, even though he got all his stuff wrong. And one of the things that endears me to him is that he said on multiple occasions, I think somewhat disingenuously, actually, I have no theory of dreams. Bam, thank you, Carl, you do. It's very valuable. It's not universal, And if you say no theory of dreams means that my theory of dreams is inadequate, sure. But there's a difference between not having one and having it be inadequate. He says, I have no theory of dreams. All I know is that when we get together to talk about dreams, something good almost always comes of it. And that's my experience. I can say with absolute confidence, when we get together to do this work, something good almost always comes of it. And it does seem to me that part of the paradox is I have to preach like a missionary inside my own movement to get people to pay attention to their dreams, because the rational foundations of Unitarian Universalism have shoved dream work into the hysterical occultism box, which is not to say there aren't a bunch of hysterical occultist dream workers. What I will say about them is, irritating though they may be, from time to time they actually have very valuable things to say. I do not object to having hysterical occultists in my dream groups. Occasionally I have to tell them to calm down a little and not use it as an occasion to try and convert everybody to their particular occultist view, but to own it and say, when I imagine this dream, being who I am, this is the stuff that comes to mind. And when they're willing to do that, their insights are often immensely valuable, because they wouldn't have come easily from any other source. And so another one of the things that dream work does is it tends to open our minds and hearts to a much wider range of intimate connection with other folks, across gender barriers and class barriers and formal education barriers and passionate barriers of religious belief. When we get together to do this work, something good almost always comes of it, which from this particular lectern needs to be accompanied by sincere gratitude to this congregation for letting me do this every year. This is a very important piece of my ministry, to actually have a chance to stand up in front of a bunch of people and tell you not only what my experience has led me to believe, but how I got there. And then, to top it all off, to be able to invite everybody to come into, at very least, the all-day workshop. And I don't know about the six-week group. My sense is we may have to extend it to 8 weeks right at the beginning. The price will be the same. That's already set. But my guess is, to do justice to all the people in the group, we're probably going to need 8 weeks. That has happened informally often enough that I feel fairly confident about saying, in all likelihood, it's going to happen again. The six-week group will probably agree to be an eight-week group. And that's one of the only ways it can be more or less guaranteed that everybody in the group will have at least one chance to work on his, her, their own dream. Which, by the way, the more dream work you've done, the less important it actually is to work your own dream. Because the deeper truth of the matter is that every time in a group we hear somebody else's dream, we do our own work on the gift of the narrative that the dreamer has given us. And I regularly find it to be the case, and only a little bit embarrassing, I regularly find it easier to do my leading edge growing work on other people's dreams than to do exactly the same work on my own dreams, because here I am, 5 decades down the road, with at least comparatively a lot of knowledge about how this all works, and I am still uniquely and selectively blind to my own stuff. And I still have the marvelous opportunity to do my own work in projected form on the gift of the narratives that everybody brings to the group. It's a tremendous gift. So, questions, comments? Yes.
When is my workshop?
I don't know. Mac, do you have dates there for the workshop?
The Saturday is
Yeah.
The group will begin on February the 13th.
And that group, in all likelihood, will meet here in this room with the chairs rearranged in a circle.
And even that is fascinating.
Yes. Even that is fascinating.
Jeremy?
Yes.
Sorry, Jeremy, I've got the microphone here.
Oh,
here.
Yes, please.
Over here, Jeremy. Hi.
Yes, there you are.
Good morning. I want to say first thank you. I've taken your workshops before. I've been in a dream group with members here for over 7 years, and I can truly say that it's one of the most impactful and transformative and consistently endearing part of my month, and we're all endlessly grateful for your guidance and your years of commitment to it. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank
my
you.
Question is, in regards to the dream that you shared, the woman, where she, you know, came to the realization of her illness. And my memory is the first great civilization of Egypt, when people were sick, the first thing they would be requested to do is to go and dream for like a week.
Yep.
And from there, the diagnosis would emerge. How did that practice as the first community health setting get so erased?
Yeah, the Greeks did it too. You can go all around the planet. The ancient Chinese did it. It is an artifact of human culture. It slipped out of fashion as those empires fell. And in some instances, those imperial dream traditions were replaced by dream traditions in the culture of the conquerors. Probably one of the most dramatic examples here today is Islam. The prophet listened to people's dreams every day. And the prayer, the call to prayer that comes from the tower, was heard first in a dream. And the dream was shared with the prophet, and the prophet said, that's it. That's the prayer we all ought to hear every day. But you, my friend, have a terrible voice. So you teach this thing that you learned in your dream to, I forget the name, who was the first muezzin, who was the first one who climbed the tower and called the community to prayer five times a day. So there is that official acknowledgement of the importance of dream within Islam, but not too surprisingly, it has become a very tender subject amongst Muslims. Because the dreams, it's part of what leads me to say, anything worthy of the noble name God is too big to be included in any tradition, including Islam. And Islam, with this inescapable emphasis on dreaming, has broken up over and over again about who gets to interpret dreams and what do they get to say, so that we are now in the odd position where women, who are forbidden to do any of this stuff publicly, have been left alone to do their own dream work at home. And they have developed, particularly in Egypt, a practice that's very much like the If It Were My Dream practice that I've been promoting. And I started promoting it without even knowing that it was a secret practice amongst Islamic women. But there's an unbroken tradition of that going all the way back to the Prophet himself. And where did the Prophet get it? He got it from the pagan religions whose 365, one for each day, idols were torn down in Mecca and replaced by the Kaaba. So who gets to interpret dreams and what they get to say is a more difficult and paradoxical question, the more rigid the religious tradition is, the more that question becomes a flashpoint. And that is still true today. There are Protestant offshoots of Islam. Subud and Baha'i are the ones we know best. But they exist in relation to standard Islam in much the same way that Presbyterianism and Lutheranism exist in relationship to Roman Catholicism. There is what I would call an archetypal pattern where expertise is in danger, is vulnerable to being erased. But again, paradoxically, the people who are most interested, the people who are most committed to paying attention to dreams as a spiritual discipline, are also statistically most likely to rebel against the religious rigidities once their own relationship with dreams evolves past the point that gave birth to the rigidities to begin with. And that can be seen again, over and over and over and over again. And regularly it is the despised, it is the ones who don't count, who aren't considered worthy of administration, who usually evolve on their own the most exciting innovations of dream work in the tradition from which they come. Islamic women are not alone in that. And I find that also really fascinating, really interesting. Yes?
Always thank you. thank you, Jeremy. I'd like to ask you to comment, please, on the shadow part of our dreams.
Okay.
And yeah, fear and denial of looking at the shadow.
Yeah.
And is that the unconscious?
Yes. Obviously, other people would like to comment on that question in addition to me. Yes.
Oh, yes. Oh, one word. I'm shocked.
I thought you were raising your hand to address the shadow question.
Oh, no. I was...
Oh, okay. Well, let me do that
then. You can't do one word.
Shadow is one of those words that Jung coined that I think is brilliant. Unlike animus and anima, which I think are terrible. Everybody's got a shadow. And I think everybody's got an animus and an anima, both. And Jung spends a great deal of his life inveighing against women who talk about their anima and men who talk about their animus. And he says, no, you don't get it. Men don't have an animus. Women don't have an anima. But in fact, they do. And it often gets confused with the shadow. The shadow is Jung's name for all of those things that exist within us, which the conscious mind cannot easily accommodate. So it tends to be repressed and denied. And the energy that it takes to repress and deny them becomes the energy that drives them. And it tends to accumulate so that the more ferocious the repression is, the more inevitable it is at some point that it will break forth. Unintended, usually in moments of crisis, and we will say things and behave in ways that we did not intend to, that are shockingly contrary to what we believe, particularly issues having to do with violence, physical violence, which once again, in the clock and calendar world, it is difficult to not take violence literally, because at the clock and calendar level, it is literal. But even there, it is a kind of mistaken literalism, because it's driven by the symbolic aspects of violence, which have to do with the intensity of interior conflict. When there is violence in a remembered dream, it is a very reliable indication that there is a struggle going on in the dreamer's psyche, oftentimes between deeply respected conscious attitudes and limiting behaviors and increasingly strong unconscious energies seeking expression. And the problem, of course, is that the symbolic appearance of violence tends to elide over into actual violence in the waking world without a second thought. That's one of the problems with being out of touch with, quotes, the unseen world, close quotes. The shadow is not understandable directly in terms of content. Like in this relatively well-educated, relatively kind and intelligent crowd, the shadow is likely to have to do with violence and selfishness and blah, blah, blah. However, I can say from experience, having done dream work in San Quentin, the shadow in San Quentin has to do with happy families and love and all kinds of things that we would think of as stuff we would like to incorporate in our personas, in our waking efforts, but which in that culture are exceedingly dangerous. You get known as someone with a soft heart, you're toast. Unless you can improvise some way to make that work. There are some out-of-the-closet gay men at San Quentin who managed to make it work. And who deserve, I think, an immense amount of respect for having done that. But it's a complicated dance. And most of the shadow dreams that I heard when I was working directly every week over there had to do with things that I imagine everybody in this room would have been glad to dream about. Happy family holidays, for example. In San Quentin, the dreams of holidays tend to increase with the holiday season, and they tend to be a source of terror. And so it's very hard to talk about these archetypes in terms of content. The moment we begin to ascribe particular content to it, we slide into the vulnerability of prejudice. We're likely to think anybody who's enough like us for their shadows to have this content are people I'm happy to be with, and anyone who doesn't are somehow human beings who aren't worth trying to get to know. It's too dangerous. It's too complicated. And one of the collective aspects of the health and wholeness that the dreams themselves serve, in my experience, is they are constantly questioning and undercutting and revealing the flaws in whatever pattern we have adopted of figuring out who the real human beings who are worth trying to get to know are, as opposed to the not quite real human beings who are not worth trying to get to know. But once we divide the world up like that inside, our dreams will begin to attack that division. It's one of the reasons why Jung keeps talking about compensation as what the dreams are doing. But I think it's health and wholeness. I don't think health is a compensation for illness and injury. And I don't think wholeness is a compensation for fragmentation and partiality. It has to do with arguments about the implications of words in English, which English was not Jung's first language. So perhaps the German word, which I can't even remember at this point, has more of that quality to it. I thought it might, and when I talked to German speakers, most of them went, no, it's pretty much like English. There isn't some hidden world in the word compensation. So I can understand why Jung says that, and he's talking about something that's real. I just think it's like saying a wooden house is made of wood, and that's it. All the metal hardware doesn't exist. And these days, you want to build a wooden house without metal hardware, good luck. It's not how it operates. So I hope that is a useful answer. Yes? I'm sorry, yes.
So two of my favorite words that you gave me were are, and I'd like you to further it, speech ripe.
Yeah. As I was implying a moment ago, I think if we were not still the inheritors of many of the worst aspects of Roman imperialism, we would have given up unconscious as our primary term for this realm. But it is. It's their primary term. Most people recognize it. I think there is a better phrase out of the old Anglo-Saxon word hoard, and that phrase is, as you say, not yet speech ripe. You could say not yet speech ready, and it would have the same implication. And it's another one of the reasons. I mean, unconscious, how can something be un and conscious all at the same time? And the Anglo-Saxon phrase answers that question. Well, it's there, but I don't have any words for it. Which is one of the reasons why the dream conversation tends to be so valuable so often. Because whenever anybody gives adequate words to that which is not yet speech ready in the dreamer's mind, or the mind of anyone in the circle who has imagined their own version of the dream, the moment somebody says something that's close enough to what they understand deeply but without words the dream to be about, there is a flash, an aha, an insight, and it becomes speech ready. It becomes speech ripe. And once it becomes speech ripe, consciousness itself has been altered. And the deeper the habit pattern that is being messed with, the more likely it is that that understanding will slip away and go back into unspeech ripeness again. But having been speech ripe, it is more ready next time to hang on to itself in the conscious mind more. It's I think, a very valuable technical way of talking about what's going on. And it is facilitated by using non-Latinate terms. Yes, Mac.
So the question of the shadow is a really interesting one to me. And I want to reflect on your remark about dreams in San Quentin.
Yeah.
In the Maslowian concept, we need to feed ourselves before we can feed others.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if that preempts the shadow in some sense. Because it seems to me more a dream of loss than shadow. Now, let me talk about what I see as the shadow, though. The shadow is the stuff that we don't want to deal with or we're afraid of in some way. But I look at that shadow as a giant gift bag. And my curiosity about it is, can I enter the shadow in my own learning? Can I bring that stuff, you know, present in my life? I mean, I'm stumbling over my shadow, but if I watch myself in this world, I can begin to see those stumbles.
Yeah.
And then I can begin to say, oh, this is going on. Mm-hmm. How do I deal with it? You know, on the level what do you call it? The clock and calendar world.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think that's such a fascinating idea.
Thank you. No argument from me. I think that's a lovely formulation.
A last question, maybe?
Okay.
I think that if you label a dream a fantasy and you write it up, you can have an enormous, unusual popular success.
Oh, yes.
Such as Harry Potter, the Wizard. And the vampires and
practically
novels.
Everything that Phil Dick ever wrote.
Yes, and Philip K. Dick, definitely. Because who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows.
Right. Indeed. Okay, well, I guess we should bring this to an arbitrary close.
Yes, thank you very much. Oh.